Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. The modern war on some drugs, really on some people who use some drugs, has gone on for more than a century. This war on some people who use some drugs has been used as a tool to oppress, to create a source of cheap labor, to justify racism, misogyny, xenophobia, and other bigotry, and to control the population. Indeed, the question arises whether that's the entire point of the exercise. In other words, the war on some people who use some drugs has never really been about the drugs. It's always been about control. A growing number of people have speculated about the connection between authoritarianism and the war on some people who use some drugs. The Open Society Foundation recently held a webinar on the subject. We're going to hear a portion of that in today's show. But first, federal paramilitary police have recently been operating with impunity in the city of Portland, terrorizing and brutalizing people in the city, including journalists, legal observers, and members of the public. U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley held a virtual town hall on Thursday, July 16th, and the federal incursion was a major topic for discussion. Here's a brief snippet.
My first question is, I want to know what you can and are planning on doing about the federal officers that have been deployed to the Portland Black Lives Matter movement. I've seen a lot of really disturbing images and stuff that doesn't seem entirely legal to me. So I'm wondering what actions you can take on that. And second question, I saw that you plan to do a constitutional amendment to ban prison labor. And I'm a big fan of this and want to know how that's going and how I as a constituent can help.
Great. Well, let me start with the first part, which is the federal officers. And Senator Wyden and I have expressed a lot of outrage and concern over the deployment, and I'll just speak for myself, very concerned that it's inflaming the situation, making it much harder to de-escalate the confrontations that are occurring on a nightly basis in Portland. I was on the phone earlier with Acting Deputy Director of the U.S. Marshals. His name is Derek Driscoll. I wanted to know how many people were deployed, what their command structure was, who makes the decision for how they act, what are their rules of engagement. He said he couldn't share anything about their rules of engagement other than they have a manual that every officer knows about. I said, yes, but you have operational protocols that change according to the situation you're in. Who's making those decisions? Who's in charge? He would not say who was in charge. I do not know if the pictures of the people in camouflage with no markings, except some of them say police, were actually U.S. Marshals. We're trying to find out. I asked specifically if they were authorized to use the rubber bullets, impact projectiles, and what the rules were on that. All I got was, they have a manual and they have training, and well, yes, but there was no answers. And the situation where Donovan LaBella was holding up a sign and was shot in the head, anyone who hasn't seen that video, it is horrific. And it's just an example of what should never happen in America when people are peacefully protesting on the street, making their points known, and be attacked in this fashion. And that the U.S. Marshals will not give us answers about how they're operating, who's in charge, what their protocols are, is completely unacceptable. And in regard to this showing up, and I don't know if this was the Marshals, but whoever's showing up and has no identification on who they are, that happens in authoritarian countries. That should never happen in a democratic republic where you're accountable to the people. So I hope we can pass some kind of law to ban the no-name authoritarian presence. So I think that we need to send these federal deployments that are causing more escalation and difficulty back. Trump sent them in a very political way to begin with, which did not help at all. It poured fuel on the fire. And I think we need to do all we can to send them home, send them back wherever they came from. That's the bottom line. And you asked me about the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment, there's a documentary called The 13th. I encourage everybody to watch. It's powerful. It's a chapter of American history that is not generally taught in our schools, at least wasn't taught when I was in grade school or high school. And that is after the Civil War. So the 13th Amendment ended slavery, but it has an exception clause in it. And it says, except for someone committed for a crime. In other words, slavery is still legal if you're committed a crime. At one time, Alabama was arresting so many Black men and then running out their services to plantations. It was almost as if the Civil War never happened. And they were funding some 75-80% of their government off this process of this legalized slavery post-Civil War, post-13th Amendment. So that involuntary servitude exception that applies to rest, it motivated some towns to go out and just sweep Black men off the street in order to turn them back into slaves. So it's a very dark, horrific history. I'm introducing a constitutional amendment that would change the 13th Amendment and remove that clause. And anything anyone can do to publicize that and encourage that would be great. It's a horrific sentence that needs to be deleted from our Constitution.
That's audio from a virtual town hall held recently by Oregon's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. He and other members of Oregon's congressional delegation, along with many local, county, and state officials, have been expressing their outrage at this most recent abuse by the feds. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I mentioned at the start, this installment of Prison Pipeline is about authoritarianism and what can be done to counter it. The Open Society Foundation recently held a web conference entitled How Authoritarianism Fuels the War on Drugs, or How the War on Drugs Continues to Fuel Authoritarianism. We're going to hear portions of that webinar today. One of the panelists was Akilah Sherrills, director of the Newark Community Street Team. The next voice you hear will be that of the moderator, Open Society Global Drug Policy Program's Matt Wilson.
You know, Akilah, I'll be curious to know, how are you processing this moment and all that's happening? And of course, the war on drugs is just one part of a very, you know, long history and complicated way that white supremacy and racism gets exerted in America. But, you know, we're seeing massive protests. We're seeing calls to defund the police. You know, how are you processing this moment? Where do you see the war on drugs coming in? And do you think it's important that we bring into this conversation of defunding the police that it's time to decriminalize the people who use drugs?
Thank you, Matt. And, you know, I just appreciate, you know, the comments from both Jeff and Sheila during this conversation. And, you know, I believe the way that I'm viewing what's happening now is that we're at an inflection point in history in terms of public safety in this country, because public safety has always been seen as a domain of police, right? You say public safety and people say police. When in reality, you know, law enforcement, police are only one small aspect of the public safety process. You know, public safety is not just the absence of violence and of crime. Public safety is the presence of well-being in the infrastructure, and I'm going to emphasize infrastructure, to support victims and survivors in their respective healing journey. Now, the thing is this, is safety is different things for different people in this country. Because, you know, as you spoke to, because of colonization and enslavement of Black folks and the genocide perpetrated against, you know, Native folks, you know, Black folks have never felt safe in this country. I mean, 350 years of chattel slavery, you know, 50 years of Jim Crow. We've literally been out of enslavement for 50 years. But because of our resiliency, you know, and our creativity and our genius in that way, you know, there is very little conversation about, you know, reparations. And I say that reparations is not just in paying money. It's about a deep dialogue and conversation about the impact of enslavement in this country and the traumatic effect that has rippled and has impacted everyone, including, you know, white Americans in this country. And so the war on drugs, you know, is essentially a war on people. I mean, I grew up in Watts in the 80s, and I watched the war on drugs blow through our community like Hurricane Katrina, destroying families, uprooting communities. I mean, it was traumatic to witness, you know, loved ones and people that you admired and respected being, you know, one, hooked on drugs, but then also to see the system's response to drug addiction, right, and drug sales. The response wasn't, you know, hey, we need more, you know, facilities to address addiction and recovery. The response was, we're going to criminalize individuals, and we're going to, you know, deploy systems like the Department of Children and Family Services. Just to give you an example, in the city of L.A., you know, Black folks only make up 8% of the population in the county, but we represent 57% of the cases of Department of Children and Family Services. If you're using drugs, literally the government can come in, take your children, and if you have, you know, two bad drug tests after that, they'll put your kids up for auction, you know, for adoption, right? And continue to destroy families, which was the legacy of enslavement in this country, right? I have two brothers who are both, one has been in prison for 30 years, you know, initially going there for drugs. And, you know, I have another brother who's been in for 15 years right now, who's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole for conspiracy to sell and distribute drugs. Okay. It's horrific, you know, what they've done to poor people in this country, but specifically what they've done to Black people in the name of the war on drugs. You know, so it's not a war on drugs, it's a war on people. And we already know the history of the war on drugs in this country in terms of Ronald Reagan, you know, the whole Iran-Contra deal. I mean, it's already, I mean, he came on television and actually apologized, you know, but yet, I mean, I don't need no apology. I need investment in infrastructure in our community in order to address, you know, the deep wounds and scars and ripples of trauma that it's caused, you know, folks in urban communities across this country. And we're still dealing with the impacts of the war on drugs now, you know. And to me, the war on drugs has a direct correlation between what happens in terms of public safety in this country. Some of you guys know that I participated in what many social justice activists call the longest running war in the history of this country, which is urban street gang wars. In LA County alone over the past 30 years, between 1983 and 2003, there were over 30,000 gang-related deaths. And it didn't include those who were permanently maimed or incarcerated for the rest of their life behind their participation. Now, just like the war on drugs, the war on gangs was a similar example. It was a label, you know, because we never called ourselves gangs, right? Society labeled us as gangs. They created a whole image around it with this, you know, super predator myth and all of these crazy ideas in which people started thinking that gangs were like the mafia, like they were centralized and organized and that they had armories and treasuries, which is the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, many people joined gangs in urban neighborhoods across this country because they lost their nuclear family to the real killer, which is poverty, which is planned and organized in a capitalist system. Because in capitalism, someone has to be poor in order for somebody to be rich, right? And so this label, gangs, was meant to dehumanize the person behind it and desensitize the public to the plight and the cries of these young Black and brown, you know, youth and young adults who are crying out for help in their own way. He didn't speak the common language of the system, right? And about 15 years ago, a prominent civil rights attorney in Los Angeles produce a report called a call to action. And it was essentially a document in which they did a study on gang violence in the city of LA and discovered that less than 3 to 5% of so-called gang members are actually committing violent crime and murder. And so, again, this dehumanizing language that the system uses in order to scapegoat us, to disenfranchise us, has been a way in which they have maintained a system of white supremacy and structural violence against a people, right? And so, and I'll just say that, you know, in the U.S., the first three news stories are always like violent stories about things that are happening in the community. And most of the time, it included gangs. So they'll say that on Central and 103rd, three 14-year-old boys were shot and killed, and people will be like, oh my God, those babies, right? But they could say that same news story, and this is how it mostly played out. Three gang members were shot and killed on Central and 103rd Street, and people will be like, yeah, they deserve it. You know, we should take these animals off the street. It's some same 14-year-old children, you know? And this is, again, a way of dehumanizing and desensitizing the public to the plight of young Black men and young folks in the community. Now, the Department of Justice, 2 years ago, in the Office of Victims of Crime, released a report saying that Black men were the least helped and the most harmed. You know, that we're essentially invisible in this culture, you know? But yet, we fill up all of the prisons and jails. When we're harmed, in community, we're automatically disqualified from receiving victim services because we're not seen as victims. You know, we're seen as perpetrators in our own respective communities. You know, it's ridiculous the type of hoop that one has to go through in order to access healing services and recovery services. You know, if you're being victimized by someone in the neighborhood and you go over to the police department and you say, hey, you know, Raheem is shooting at me, they'll say, where's your gun? You know, so In cities like Chicago, like Los Angeles, where we're spending $1.8 billion annually on policing, we get no protection from the justice system. You know, it's like there's this whole narrative around Black on Black crime. I mean, somebody benefits from that narrative, you know, because, you know, Black on Black violence is about proximity and place. Latinos kill each other, white folks kill each other, because it's about proximity. It's not about no Black on Black violence. That narrative, it's a false narrative, you know, because someone benefits from that whole white supremacist ideation, you know, and that's, and understand, that's how we hold it, right? I want to say, you know, just something about our system of services to try to support people in their healing journey, because as I said, you know, safety means different things to different people. And that in public safety, I mean, you don't measure safety of people in urban communities with crime stats. Crime stats is a totally inadequate way of being able to measure whether somebody feels safe or not. Again, if someone is harmed in the community, say Raheem is hustling and selling drugs because of these complex social issues and stuff that are unaddressed in order to make ends meet, he gets shot, he goes to the hospital, and the police shows up and they put victim suspect on that police report, which automatically disqualifies them from receiving victim services. So they can't get counseling. They can't get, you know, if they die, you know, their families who can't afford to bury them in the first place, you know, is now responsible. You know, they got to take out all types of loans and go in debt in order to bury their loved ones. The ripple impact, you know, of the trauma on their siblings, on their children, you know, they get no counseling and no therapy. And so this problem has been allowed to fester, you know, and ripple in our community in a way that has created like these you know, just unfathomable conditions. And so therefore, you know, systems like the war on drugs, it's just an overlay. You know what I'm saying? It's a way of consistently covering up the original wound in this country, which is manifest destiny, right? Which is the whole rule of colonization in which folks came in and murdered people and then utilized language, you know, to cover it up. You know, so they say, oh, Black people were slaves, as if we were born slaves. No, we were enslaved, you know, in this country. And someone enslaved us, you know. And so to say that, it puts the onus and the responsibility on the perpetrator, not on the victim. You know what I'm saying? We were victimized as a result of enslavement in this country. When we look at law enforcement, the history of policing is rooted in returning enslaved people back to bondage. Those systems haven't changed much over the centuries that it's been in place. You know, there was just a report in North Carolina that came out yesterday that three officers were terminated because they were talking in the car and didn't realize that their camera was on and recording them. And it was basically saying that they couldn't wait, you know, and was looking for the opportunity to kill Black people in Wilmington. You know, it's you know, our law enforcement system is rout with white supremacy you know, implicit bias and systems of structural violence that are very difficult and hard to change. But I tell you, you know, I've been working as an activist advocate organizer for 30 years to change. I mean, both internally, like working to stop the killing in our community. I mean, the first 2 years of the peace treaty in Watts, gang homicides dropped 44%, you know. So we know how impacted people know how to resolve and solve their own problems. The thing is that sometimes the system doesn't want to give us the investment and the resources to do it because they want to invest in the symptom of the problem, not in the root causes, you know, because there's a huge benefit and payoff to being a victim, right? They make all kinds of systems and jobs and opportunities for other people off our victimization, right? But, you know, I currently run the city of Newark's community-based public safety initiative, right? And so we've been talking about the whole national defund the police campaign. Now, you know, I'm like, I probably fall somewhere in the middle of that. I mean, you know, there are folks in our community who are highly conservative, and the last thing they want to see happen is the police be defunded, you know? But understand, there are complementary strategies that exist. The data actually proves it now. In urban communities all across the country, that shows that highly trained residents utilizing a relationship-based strategy through a public health frame can actually reduce violence and crime in a much more cost-effective way without all of the collateral, you know, and unintended consequences better, you know? In Newark, where I currently serve, you know, the Honorable Mayor Raj J. Baraka, for four consecutive years in a row, you know, we've had decreases in homicides and violent crime in the city. Prior to our work that we launched in 2014, I mean, Newark was on the top 50 most violent city list and the top 10 most violent city list for the past 50 years, right? 2016, we had double-digit reductions in homicide as a result of our coordinated public safety strategy in the city. That included, you know, working through this public health frame. That included bringing in a new public safety director that oversaw police, EMS, and the police department. Our health department and community-based agencies collectively working together. And we've consistently decreased violence and crime. In 2019, we had a negative 48% reductions in homicide in the South Ward, where all of the violence was actually happening in the community. And just yesterday, the mayor put forth an initiative. So we're talking about defund the police. No, we're talking about reallocating resources into infrastructure that helps to decrease and sustain, you know, violence reduction in our city. The mayor moved 5% of the police department's $230 million budget. It's the beginning, right? $230 million budget, 5% into a new department of violence prevention and trauma wellness. You know, this is setting precedents, you know, in the state of New Jersey, and it'll set precedents across the country in terms of this strategy. Because now we'll be in a position to hire, you know, wellness workers for every 25 officers that we have in the city. We're going to take the old fifth precinct, I mean, the old first precinct police station where the 67 rebellion, you know, happened, you know, that in 1965 in Watts, you know, we had a rebellion against police abuse and excessive force that waved the whole country. The second city in it was Newark, right? And so we're taking that old precinct, you know, and we're converting it into a museum and also to a place where we're going to co-locate all of our community-based public safety initiatives. We have a great working relationship with law enforcement. We implemented a trauma to trust training so that our law enforcement understands trauma and the communities in which they serve. Because although folks grow up here, sometimes we're disconnected, you know, from the experience here. And law enforcement is a culture now. It's like, you know, this cowboy mentality that exists in policing. Cops can't even say that I'm having an emotional or traumatic experience, because to say that means that they get degunned and desked, you know, threatening their ability to provide for their own families, right? We want our officers to get the proper counseling and therapy and whatever healing modality is necessary so that they can begin to engage the public in a more humane way so that we can reduce excessive force issues, right? And so it's a monumental thing to do. But again, it's a very small step, you know, in a larger dynamic that we have to continue to engage in this country.
That was Akilah Sherrills, director of the Newark Community Street Team, speaking on a web conference entitled How Authoritarianism Fuels the War on Drugs, or How the War on Drugs Continues to Fuel Authoritarianism. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. When I got involved in drug policy reform back in the 1980s, Democrats and Republicans in Congress were engaged in a political bidding war to see who could appear to be, quote, tougher, end quote, on drugs. Ideas were being floated that should never have seen the light of day in a free country. For decades, cities throughout the U.S. sent heavily armed paramilitary police forces into communities of color to act as occupying armies under the pretense of drug enforcement. For years, we the public tolerated, oh hell, encouraged, extraordinarily egregious violations of civil rights, physical assaults, and even killings by police officers so long as the cops said the word drugs. It was usually a lie, but the public didn't care. And they're really clumsy lies, too. They're really offensive, kind of clumsy, obvious lying that comes with knowing that there are no consequences and the feeling that you can just act with impunity because you believe that the public you serve only cares about white lives. Which is why it's so vital that people demand an end to business as usual and speak up and say loudly and clearly that black lives matter. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you've been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! Regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard.